Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. I'm joined this week by Paul Moses, former Newsday City editor and now a professor of journalism at Brooklyn College and the City University of New York. Welcome, Paul.
Welcome, Tim. Thank you very much.
Now, Paul, we're here to talk about your new book, which is called The Saint and the Sultan, The Crusades, Islam, and Francis of Assisi's Mission of Peace. Now, we're talking now around the time of St. Francis's feast. Maybe you can just give us kind of a brief description of this episode in his life, and then we'll go into a little more detail.
Sure, Tim. It's not one of the best-known episodes in Francis's life, but in the year 1219, he went to Egypt to be there for the Fifth Crusade. And while he was there in the Christian camp, he got the idea of crossing over to the enemy camp and seeking out the Sultan of Egypt, Malik al-Kamil, and trying to convert him.
This was not Francis's first time in which he attempted to reach out to an Islamic leader. Why was he interested in this kind of interreligious dialogue?
Well, I mean, I guess the bottom line is that he wanted to convert these leaders. But I think we have to understand something about Francis and what really motivated him, besides the desire to win over souls. And that is, Francis was a soldier in his younger days. He was in the Assisi's army. Many of his fellow soldiers were massacred in a battle with Perugia, and Francis himself spent a devastating year in prison. He was shattered by that, and it was after that that he eventually arrived at his own conversion experience. So I think that revulsion at warfare was something that really shaped Francis. And, you know, if there was another way to do it, he would like to do it without war. He wanted to approach the Muslims peacefully, unarmed. It was a countercultural way of doing it at that time. And I think that's what drove him to seek out Muslim leaders. He could have spent his time trying to convert heretics in Europe, or non-Christians, but this is something that drove him. He actually tried to reach the Sultan of Morocco a few years before that. This was really his third attempt to reach out to Muslims, and finally he succeeded in reaching Sultan Malik al-Kamil.
Just to give some context here, as you mentioned, you know, the Crusades were going on. It was the Fifth Crusade, correct?
Yeah. When Francis was born, well, a few years after he was born, the great Muslim warrior Saladin in 1187 reconquered Jerusalem. And, you know, for much of the next century, different popes attempted to win it back. So we're up to the Fifth Crusade here. It ended in a disaster for the Christians also. So that's kind of the historical context. And the larger picture, too, is it's a very violent time within Europe. You know, all the cities are divided between merchants and noblemen, and they're at war with each other, and the emperor's forces are at war with the pope's forces. So it's a very contentious time, and Francis, by adopting this lifestyle of poverty, adopted a lifestyle that made him unable to participate in that kind of violence. Once he adopted that lifestyle, he then proceeded to try to make peace wherever he could, going to cities that were, you know, having wars and preaching against them. And so I see his trip to the Sultan as an extension of that.
Right, of course. And Francis has, I mean, a long history of peacemaking. He's known for that. In this encounter in particular, you know, it's so unlikely that these two men would have met roughly the same age. How did Francis wind up getting an audience with the Sultan?
Well, first of all, Francis went to the cardinal, who was kind of the leader of the crusade force, Cardinal Pelagius, who was a very disagreeable character, as presented in the different chronicles. And Cardinal Pelagius did not want Francis to do this because he was afraid Francis would be killed and it would be blamed on the cardinal. But Francis insisted that he go, and the cardinal eventually relented. So Francis took another friar named Illuminato, and they walked. Enemy camp was about maybe 8 miles to the south. This is along the banks of the Nile. And eventually they got close enough to the camp so that the Muslim soldiers seized him. Some accounts say they beat him. I'm not sure how seriously to take that. But clearly Francis took a lot of risk because he could have been taken for a spy, and they did horrible things to spies during that war. And Francis insisted on being taken to the Sultan, And sure enough, they brought him to the tent of the Sultan. You know, this is attested to in a number of medieval accounts, some written within a few years or even one quite close to the time.
From what you write in your book, it's Francis' appearance helped. You know, he was obviously not a soldier. You know, he was dressed in this sackcloth. And as you say, that it reminded the Sultan of perhaps some people in his own tradition who were also kind of men of poverty or men of kind of humble means.
Right. Well, you're getting into how the Sultan viewed this, which I found to be a really interesting part of this story. And first of all, the Sultan, from the Western point of view, he was the enemy. One French bishop who wrote a great deal on this crusade called him a cruel beast. But in fact, if you look at it from the point of view of Christians in Egypt, they really like Sultan al-Kamil. If you read their chronicles, he probably stands out as the Sultan who is most favorable to Christians in Egypt's history. He was very involved in the disputes of the Egyptian Christians. They had some major blowouts over choosing a patriarch, and he handled these with a lot of sensitivity for Christians' traditions. So he was not the character that the Christians thought him to be, and probably who Francis expected to meet. And you mentioned that there are things in the Sultan's tradition that would lead him to view Francis favorably. One of the interesting things when you really start looking into the Sultan and who he was, you find that there was a strong influence in his court of Persian Sufism. So we're sort of familiar today with the Sufi tradition within Islam. It's a little more mystic. And the Persian variety especially dealt very open way with other religions. And so there are, you know, famous poets who al-Kamil brought into his court. He loved their Sufi-influenced poetry. He had a religious advisor who was a very famous Persian Sufi who he relied on a lot. And so he could well have looked at Francis as kind of not that he thought that Francis was a Muslim Sufi, but he would have seen the similarities. There are similarities in the way they dressed, in their kind of austere lifestyle, in their emphasis on God's presence and God's love. These are all things that would have appealed to the Sultan. And they did, in fact, talk. He allowed Francis to stay in his court for at least 3 days and allowed him to preach to his soldiers, which is just extraordinary because they're in the middle of a war.
When you went about trying to reconstruct what exactly happened in this encounter, what resources were available, and did you have to do some reconstruction?
In the book, I try to make it very clear where the information is coming from so readers can judge for themselves, you know, how strong the facts are. First of all, many, if not almost all, the writings on Francis from within the first 100 years of his death have been pulled together by the Franciscan Institute. There's a four-volume set published by New City Press. So that's a great starting point. Then there's, you know, you really have to put things within the context of the period, and that, you know, involved a good deal of research also. And then I think it's important in the way you approach these documents because they can't be taken literally.
Right. You mentioned in the book that you approached this story as if you were an investigative journalist. Obviously, that's your background, and you had to do a little digging.
Right. Yes. I've been a reporter for a long time, and, you know, you deal with people who are powerful, and you learn, to look at documents that are issued by the government and others and look through them and between the lines and pick out what they're really saying. And, you know, the politics of the church and larger society in the 13th century, the politics of the Franciscan order itself, had a big role in what kind of picture of Francis was presented over the years through the different medieval, I guess we'll call them biographies.
Now there's obviously the meeting between these two individuals is the heart of your book, but what came of it? How did it affect Francis? Why don't we start there?
Francis did not convert the Sultan. to make the story short, I would say they hit it off, though. There was a great deal of respect between them, which is, again, pretty amazing given the circumstances of their meeting. I would say Francis was quite affected by this meeting with the Sultan, to the point that after he gets back, he writes something called a letter to the rulers of the people. He wanted the leaders everywhere to see to it that Christians were called to prayer periodically through the day in public and prayed in public. And it seems very much like what Muslims do when they're called to pray five times a day. I'm certainly not saying Francis wanted to be a Muslim or anything like that, but I think that what he saw, he respected, which isn't to say he didn't think they needed to be converted to Christianity. But I think he saw something there that he liked. And when he got back, he also was revising the rule of his order. And he wrote a chapter that dealt with how to approach Muslims and other non-Christians. And he essentially said, one way to do this is not to go there and preach and get into arguments, but to just live among the Muslims peaceably and to be subject to them, be subject to them. That's a pretty amazing thing, because right at that point when he was writing this, the Crusaders were, you know, hunkered down on the banks of the Nile, hoping that they could, you know, conquer all Egypt and basically break the back of Islam, is what they were trying to do. And Francis was saying, no, let's live peaceably among them. The best thing we could do is just to show what it means to be a Christian. Not even preaching it, just show them. And that's really pretty revolutionary. Unfortunately, it didn't really get picked up on very well in his era.
Yeah, that was my follow-up question. I mean, did anybody listen to Francis, or was it he pretty much ignored?
You know, eventually a later and final version of the rule was completed, and this really is washed out of it. But when Francis got back from Egypt, it was a really hard time of his life. He had a number of diseases, particularly a serious problem with his vision that he had evidently picked up while he was away. And I know this is maybe summarizing too much, but basically his order was being snatched away from him. You know, he wasn't really maybe practical enough to lead a great order that can become what the Franciscans became today. And so he was kind of put up on a pedestal, but ignored, and he really hated that. So it was a very difficult time. He went into even sort of a depression for a while after he got back. So his different ideas tended to be kind of, well, that's what they just didn't get picked up on. It was a strange time of his life. I think kind of a sad time in a lot of ways.
What happened from there in the Sultan's, if we return to his story, you know, how did his story continue after the meeting?
The Sultan's army wound up winning the Fifth Crusade after some very anxious days and nights. And what happened was that the Christians kind of, the cardinal who headed the army insisted on attacking, even though the military leadership thought they should wait and maybe negotiate with the Sultan, because the Sultan was willing to turn over Jerusalem to the Crusaders. I don't know if this sounds like anything that happened today. But anyway, the civilian leadership took over, that is the cardinal, and the troops were basically caught in the Nile. The Sultan's people managed to lift open the floodgates and basically flood out the Christian army, and Sultan could have had every one of them killed. But again, he's a very wise leader, and he saw it to his advantage to make peace, get these Christians out of Egypt as soon as he could, end the siege of a city of Damietta at the mouth of the Nile where many of his own people were dying of hunger. And so the Sultan treated the Christian invaders royally, to the point that one of the chief Christian chroniclers wrote to him saying, "You are truly, you know, al-Kamil. Kamil means perfect. You're the perfect one. You lived up to your name." So the Christians wound up, at least for a few years, with a great appreciation of Sultan al-Kamil. Sultan al-Kamil, later there was another crusade that was launched led by Frederick II, the emperor who was a very interesting historical character. And he and Sultan al-Kamil kind of negotiated with each other, and the Sultan actually gave the Christians control of Jerusalem for a period of time. Holy hell was heaped on both the Sultan and the emperor from their respective religious leaders for doing this. And the Sultan, you know, lived a good full life and died, you know, of natural causes. It's buried in Damascus now.
Now, you did some traveling for this book. You went back to Egypt. Where else did you travel to?
I was mainly in Egypt and in Assisi. And the trip to Egypt was really interesting. First of all, I got to speak to some of the Franciscans who were there. Archbishop Michael Fitzgerald was interesting to speak to also. He's the papal nuncio now in Cairo. And I got to just kind of get the lay of the land and the sense for where everything is. And I think one of the best things I did was the Egyptian government is restoring a very old mosque in Damietta, the city where the war was taking place. The mosque dates to the 600s, so it's from the earliest, from the dawn of Islam. And during the Crusade, the Christians succeeded in conquering Damietta and turning the mosque into a church temporarily. And so I knew that I was in a place where everybody I had written about had been. Francis would have been there after Damietta was won. The Sultan would have been there after Damietta was reconquered. And some of the, you know, dashing knights and the cardinal, the offensive cardinal, all those people would have been there at one time or another. So that was kind of one of the highlights for me of going to Egypt.
Now, you know, obviously we're in a time now where we still have ongoing wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and other wars that, you know, the United States is not involved in. What can we learn from Francis's attitudes about war?
Francis was, first of all, very skeptical about war. We don't see Francis as a social analyst, but Francis' social analysis came through his actions. Okay? It was not a time where you could write a book attacking the Crusade very easily or go out in a demonstration. But Francis, everything he did was kind of a performance meant to jar people. And whether it was picking up a worm off the sidewalk to protect it or going to visit the Sultan unarmed, he's trying to set a certain example. I think today he's saying to us to be skeptical of some of the underpinnings of warfare. He was very skeptical of violence of any in any form. He really saw war also as kind of an extension of glory seeking, of ego, and so he, you know, stressed humility so much. So I do think there's a lot we can learn from what he did. But again, I think basically he's saying is to give example. That's the best way to win over people.
Now, I mentioned the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. You began writing this book not long after 9/11, and you were involved in covering some of those events when you worked at Newsday. How did those days feed into your desire to tell this story?
Yeah, I mean, when I first encountered this story, I think I was leafing through the Little Flowers of St. Francis, that famous book, and I saw a reference to it, and I was like, can this be true? Could this have really happened? And it intrigued me because, you know, the history of Christians and Muslims is so dismal. But if such a powerful figure in our tradition as St. Francis saw ways to try to bridge that, and he had this encounter with the Sultan, who was a nephew of Saladin, in which they really respected each other, maybe that story needs to be retold a little bit. Maybe we can't have this automatic suspicion that seems to have grown after 9/11. So that kind of drove me to it. And also, I started seeing some parallels between the Fifth Crusade and the war in Iraq, principally that the Pope who declared it, Innocent III, he had intelligence. The Patriarch of Jerusalem wrote him a letter saying, we think we can negotiate with the Sultan. We think we can negotiate for Jerusalem. And, you know, the Pope never said that when he was calling for a crusade. It seemed kind of familiar. You know, obviously it's two very different times and places, but, you know, I think, you know, it calls for a certain skepticism when the call goes out to start a new war.
Well, again, the book is The Saint and the Sultan, The Crusades, Islam, and Francis of Assisi's Mission of Peace. And we want to thank Paul Moses for joining us.
Thanks very much, Tim.
Thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine podcast. Check online this week for a review of the career of Michael Jackson from Father Terence Klein and what he may say about our own future. Also, we have a piece from the archives by Sister Mary Luke Tobin on her observations from being an auditor at Vatican II. Reminder, you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.